I want to start with universities. There have been places where people come together who are grown up like yourselves to study, to read, to learn things in almost all civilizations. You have them in Tibetan monasteries, you have them in madrasas in Islamic civilization, you have them traditionally in the past in China and in Japan. You had Confucian schools in China. So there have always been something which, in a rough way, looks like a bit like a university. But the university, as a separate institution of knowledge and learning, which is separated off from the formal religious organization, from the state, which has its own money, its own accounts, and which continues for generation after generation after generation, and which is dedicated to teaching a wide range of subjects, not just religious knowledge, but also mathematics, geography, languages, philosophy. That kind of formal university, it comes from the Latin universitas, which means an institution, a universal institution for knowledge. That kind of university was a West European invention. Some people say it started in Spain in the 8th, 9th century, some in Italy in the 11th, 12th century. But certainly by the 13th, 14th century, there were a growing number of universities, particularly in Italy, Spain, and France. And according to one historian of science, for instance, the dynamic elements missing in medieval China and Islam were universities and scientific academies of the Western type. And another great historian of philosophy and science writes, the first uniquely Western feature from which a somewhat more solid basis for science sprouted and had been available elsewhere was the rise of the medieval university. The universities began to spread all over central Western Europe. University of Paris, University of Padua, and so on, were famous universities in the 12th, 13th century. And by the 14th century, that is, by about 1350, there were 50 or 60 universities around Europe. My own University of Cambridge had been founded in 1208, and the University of Oxford 20, 30 years earlier. And I had always assumed that what happened was that these medieval universities in the West grew and grew, and then they spread to America and so on. And the university tradition is just one continuation from medieval universities. I was therefore very surprised when recently I wrote a book about Cambridge University, which will hopefully be coming out from commercial press in translation by Sharon Huang within the next 3 or 4 weeks. This book on Cambridge led me to do research on the growth of universities, and I was very surprised to discover that almost all over Europe, universities more or less disappeared. Between the 13th, 14th centuries, when they were widespread, and the time of Napoleon in the early 19th century. The idea of free college-based universities with their own funding and independent of government more or less died out, except in two universities in Europe, Oxford and Cambridge. And But the continuation of that idea of a university was enormously important. Our modern world could not have been invented without universities. That's not to say that much knowledge came from outside the university, of course it did. But the tradition of independent, high-level research, which continued in Oxford and Cambridge in particular, has helped give birth to the modern world. To take my own university, much of the world's greatest poetry was written by a succession of poets who went to Cambridge, which also was associated with Cambridge, but then later Spencer, Milton, Donne, Herbert, Marvell, Dryden, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, all went to Cambridge. Often they hated it and they said it was no use at all, but when later on in their lives they sometimes wrote poetry about it, and it's clear that it inspired them in various ways. The same happened with scientists. The development, the first discovery of magnetism, for instance, in Cambridge by William Gilbert, and then you go through great scientists, obviously the greatest of them, Newton, Isaac Newton, continues non-stop for 400 or 500 years in Cambridge and to a certain extent Oxford. And without this work, without the work on electricity, which also Gilbert pioneered, the work on optics of Newton, on the circulation of the blood by William Harvey at Cambridge, on gravity, Newton. Without that, it is almost certain that we couldn't have had an industrial revolution or a modern world. The deep fundamental understanding of the laws of nature, which lie behind cumulative discoveries and cumulative economic growth, relies on these major discoveries, which were made largely in Cambridge, and largely over this period. More, just as important as the actual particular discoveries, however, were a way of thinking. A tradition which is what disappeared all over Europe between about the 15th, 16th century and the early 19th century, an independent way of thinking, of inquiring by argument, by disagreeing, by contest, by confrontation, by disputation, which was the main teaching method in the medieval period, by putting forward a hypothesis and testing it. I may mention him again, but I've done about 180 interviews of leading thinkers at Cambridge and elsewhere in the UK and abroad, including recently Professor Libeson, which are up on my website if you go and you see a picture on the front page. Behind that are about 180 interviews with great scientists, about 10 Nobel Prize winners and others. And one of them was a man called Sidney Brenner, who was a colleague of mine at King's College, Cambridge. And he describes his life very well, and he describes how for 20, 25 years he worked with Thomas Crick, who was Crick and Watson discovered DNA, as you know. And Sidney Brenner describes how every day they used to just argue. They just sit there in their office with a blackboard, scribbling. Crick would say, "What about this?" And Brenner said, "No use, try that." And for 20 years they did that, and it was a kind of Darwinian evolutionary process whereby bad ideas would be tested, eliminated, gradually they would suddenly stumble on a good one and they would try it out. And this went on, and it goes on all the time in Cambridge and in other universities, I'm sure it does here. And the result in Brenner's case was a Nobel Prize with Sir John Sulston in 2003. All sorts of absurd and crazy ideas. Einstein said, unless an idea starts off as absurd, there's no chance for it. So you had to have arguments and try out things, crazy ideas, which I'm trying out in these lectures on you. And you will say, oh, but surely, and then I'll have to modify it. But you try these hypotheses, and then, as the great mathematician Poincaré put it, guessing before testing. How often must I tell you that is how science proceeds? You guess something, and you test it. And this is a method which was developed, of course, by another Cambridge scientist, Francis Bacon, who is reputedly the founder of the experimental method in science. And it's very effective at generating new knowledge by hypothesis. Now, of course, there were many great non-English scientists, and some of them worked in universities. The great ones of the 16th century, of course, are Copernicus, Galileo, and in the early part of the 17th century, Descartes, and others. But if you look at the history of Galileo and Italy, you find that by the late 17th century, science in Italy has almost ceased. There's no more real science in Italy. Universities are dead. Same in Spain, which had been great universities earlier on. And the same to a large extent in 18th century France and in Germany. And in the end, Napoleon abolished all the universities, more or less, and started again. So a combination of religious reform, what we call the Counter-Reformation, the Catholic resurgence over much of Europe, and the growing power of the royal houses of Europe, which felt threatened and jealous of what was happening, meant that much of the freedom of thought, which had led to the Renaissance and to the great flourishing of science in Italy and elsewhere in the 16th century, tended to die out in the 17th century. What this shows is really what is the theme of these lectures, which is that, as you know, what I'm suggesting is that capitalism is the separation of the economy from society. Religion and ideology and intellectual things is here. Politics is here. And modern science is really the development of the separation out of this area, so that people in this area can think, guess, say what they like, without threatening, being threatened or threatening these people, particularly the politicians, the leaders, and other spheres. So by separating religion, politics, economy, and society, there was a space left for specialist institutions like universities to flourish. All over the continent, what happened was that as wealth grew and power of the centre, culminating in Louis XIV and so on, people realised, this is a saying which some people say Foucault invented, knowledge is power. In fact, it was Francis Bacon. Knowledge is power. You know things, you have power. And as a result, those who are powerful, in other words, the political leaders, are worried by knowledge. They watch it because an idea can destroy a kingdom. But strangely, in England, because of this separation and because of other factors which I'll go into, the wealth and power of the upper middle class and so on, you get the growth of free universities where people could think and act most of the time without worry of the political repercussions. And this idea, of course, was spread to America. Something like half of the first people who set up the universities in America came from two Cambridge colleges. Corpus Christi and Emmanuel colleges. Harvard, for example, John Harvard was from, set up Harvard was from Emmanuel, I think. And so the idea of free universities spread to America, and it was maintained in England. And this was just part of something wider, which is, I call roughly rational thought. By rational, I mean that you can think without worrying about whether you're going to hurt your family, whether you're going to be poorer as a result of it economically, whether the state and the leaders are going to jump on you. If there is a problem, you can just say, well, this looks like the best solution to the problem, without worrying about all the other things around it. Normally, where you have non-modern societies, where all these are fused together, and particularly religion and politics are fused together, in other words, the religious leaders, the Catholic clergy, or the imams, or whoever it is, the Confucian leaders, are working with the politicians. In that situation, an intellectual of any kind cannot afford to stray out of a very narrow area. If you apply just pure logic to the world and you say, actually, what the emperor has done is rubbish, what a silly solution, you'll be dead. If you say the Pope is complete nonsense, it's, you know, you can't water is wine, and you can't, this isn't the blood of Jesus Christ, it's just a bit of wine, then you will be thrown to the Inquisition, as Galileo discovered. So your ideas are stopped and constrained by political forces. But in England, you could let your mind go where you wanted to a large extent. There's always, you have to be a bit careful, but for example, David Hume, a great Scottish philosopher, was able to think about the social basis of religious systems, as he did, and be pretty free in his thoughts about that, that we create our religions. Or John Locke would apply logic to political systems and say that the king is just another person like us who has a contract to deliver a reasonable political system, and if he doesn't and if he is a threat, then we get rid of him. Or Charles Darwin, who discovered that we weren't all created in one week, as the Bible said, 4,044 years ago, and was able to say that. They could do it with some security, whereas in most civilizations you can't. If you say things that are unwelcome to the establishment, whether religious or political, then it's not just that you may be thrown into prison, but all your children will be thrown into prison, all your relatives will be tortured. And so you may be scribbling away and your wife comes and sees what you're doing. She says, no, no, you mustn't say that, we'll be in trouble. And who is going to be able to stand up to this sort of endless pressure of constraint? So what developed was a value-free exploration in a measurable world. People were not trying to prove things of a general kind. They were interested in investigating the world just in itself. They didn't start with fixed principles, but they had guesses, hypotheses, and they refined all these by observation. The great method which Newton invented was known as the hypothetico-inductive method. That basically you have a guess. You guess that the Earth goes round the Sun. That's the hypothesis. You then look at some observations. You test that theory. And if it seems to work, you induce from that some laws, which leads you into some more guesses. So it's no good in any of your fields, whatever your work is, it's no good starting and saying to yourself, well, I won't have any theories or ideas, I'll just let the evidence speak to me. Evidence is dead. Facts are dead. You have to guess first. Guessing before demonstrating is Poincaré. It was Einstein's only equal in the early 20th century. It's a mathematician, really. Guessing before demonstrating. So you guess, then you demonstrate, guess again. And that's how we proceed. And that's how Newton proceeded. And this kind of mind of guessing, of having what is known as an open philosophy, Karl Popper has talked about the open society, and others have talked about it's an open world where nothing is fixed, nothing is proven. You take nothing for granted. You question everything. It's built into the teaching system. When I teach in Cambridge, and I have students, I tell them, they come along and they start reading out an essay or something and they repeat what someone says. And I said, well, do you agree with this? And they say, no, I don't agree. I said, well, why didn't you say? Why do you just repeat this stuff? Challenge it. If I say nonsense, challenge me. It's like a game. In English, always like the metaphor of a game. It's no good if, you know, a game of tennis, you know, I pick the ball and I've got a student there and I go like that and the student then like this. They've got to hit it back at me and try and beat me at it. So it's a method of competition and game playing which lies behind an open world where anything is possible. The Greeks may have said it, Aristotle may have said it, Galileo may have said it, but is it right? Let's try and prove them wrong. That's the aim. And you find this in English science and philosophy from the 12th, 13th century. People like Roger Bacon and Bishop Grisquest, up to the 20th century, where the greatest physicists were working in the same building as I taught in, Rutherford and others, splitting the atom. So you find this long tradition of questioning, arguing. And it's not just in science, pure science. It's also in practical matters. You apply it to agriculture, you test and see whether this works or that doesn't work. You don't just do what your grandfather or other people said, you test it out, same in shipbuilding or everywhere. And the result is, in England, a kind of very pragmatic, practical kind of science grew up. And a mode of thinking which is pragmatic. Pragmatic means practical, really. Pragmatic thought. Very empirical, that is, very concerned with the actual physical world, not just with ideas. This is why the English didn't like Descartes or French philosophy. They wanted to grasp hold of actual things and then test them. Is this water here, or is it gin or some alcohol? Test it and see. And so you get from, there's a strong trend in English philosophy of pragmatism or practical thought, which is taken to America. The greatest contribution of American philosophers is pragmatism. From up people like Peirce and James and others. And you find it in David Hume and other English philosophers. Very practical, pragmatic, empirical thinking. And you find it in another of the major schools of philosophy in England, utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is a philosophy which judges everything by cost-benefit, pleasure-pain principles. Does it work? Is it good? Is it bad? Practical things like that. Now, if you take science as something which should be applied to the real world, it's based on gathering and looking at facts. It believes in facts. Many civilizations don't actually believe that there are things out there. Maya, illusion in Hindu philosophy, much of Taoism, many philosophies of the East don't believe in actual facts, immaterial of how we look at them. They were sort of postmodern before the postmodernity was invented. So basically, there were facts to be investigated. It was our task as Christians to investigate them. and they should be useful. England is a country ruled by shopkeepers, as I mentioned, or at least influenced by shopkeepers. The English wanted to make money, they wanted to have a good life, and science was a way of doing this. And everyone got involved in this. In most societies, the very successful and the very clever get more and more into abstract thought. They go off and they become withdrawn from the world, or noblemen. The famous, I should have brought it, but at home I've got a Chinese mandarin's nail guard. Some of you, have any of you seen those things where you protect your nail with a long silver thing? And that's to show that a mandarin never touches, does anything. You can't type at a computer with a mandarin nail guard on. You can't go out and dig fields with a mandarin nail guard on. You are too senior to do anything with your hands. Whereas the English love doing things with their hands. Newton grind his own lenses for himself. Robert Boyle, who was a very rich nobleman, tinkered around in his garden shed or equivalent in discovering the vacuum. So the English like, and it wasn't below their dignity, or even the richest people in the country, to have hobbies of practical things and discovering practical things. So basically, you get a world where the social class system allows anyone to join in the hunt for new discoveries. Newton was just from a very simple background, as was Michael Faraday, a great 19th century inventor and scientist. You have a legal system which is based on argument, confrontation, common law of England, which had trained Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon really applied in his philosophy of science the legal background and training he'd had in putting an argument, having a counter-argument, and trying to win by logic and discover new things and elicit facts by questioning, as he famously put it, put nature to the question. And above all, or equally, there is an idea that people should be trusted. Science is based on trust. If someone makes a discovery here, you have to trust that person. You can't often replicate the discovery. So English science was based on a great deal of trust, just as its economy was. And finally, it was based on games and sport. The autobiography of Crick is called What Mad Pursuit. That means chasing after something. The English love games, and in the end, science in England is a practical activity, but it is also a game. And it's a game which we love playing, mental games. And we're not frightened of losing, and we're not frightened of someone, the umpire or the king, rushing onto the field and saying, you mustn't play that game. We play the game. And it's a great pleasure to have a chance to play that game with you. Thank you very much.